This is part one of a three-part series. This is Ask a Biologist, a program about the living world, and I'm Dr. Biology. In today's show, we'll learn about one of the most fashionable of all insects, butterflies, and also some answers to a few very interesting questions, such as, are butterflies legally blind, and just how do butterflies and most insects see the world? To help us understand these amazing animals, we will be talking with biologist Ron Witowski, who is a professor in the School of Life Sciences at Arizona State University. We will discuss his research that includes butterfly vision and coloration. Dr. Ron, as he is also known in his other life, as a musician, plays fiddle in country western, bluegrass, and jazz bands. He's released a solo album called Violin Alone, and we'll get a chance to listen to one of the songs later in the show. Right now, let's welcome our guest scientist. Welcome, Professor Witowski.
Thank you for having me here.
Before we get to the details of your research, I'd like to talk just a little bit about butterflies in general. We know that butterflies are a popular topic for people of all ages. Their wide range of colors and patterns are certainly one of the reasons butterflies get so much attention. However, their role in the food web is maybe more important than their beauty. Just how do butterflies fit into the ecosystem?
Well, we tend to think of ecosystems as ways in which systems by which energy from the sun moves through plants to animals and on into various forms of energy or nutrients, things like nitrogen, carbon, oxygen. So your question is, what roles do butterflies play in that movement of nutrients through the ecosystem? And butterflies play both the roles that animals typically play in those situations. One is that they get eaten, and so they serve as a source of nutrients for other animals. And there's lots of interesting things about that. They do get eaten by birds, sometimes small mammals, by other insects. I mean, there's so many different kinds of butterflies, it's hard to make a generalization, but they do get eaten by them. Their larvae also get eaten by a variety of animals in the ecosystem. So they serve as a way for energy to get from them to the next level in the ecosystem. They also consume material in the ecosystem, and in particular, the larvae eat plants, and which have gathered sunlight, energy from the sunlight, and turned it into plant material. So the larvae actually are serve to move nutrients from the ecosystem into the butterflies. And also the adult butterflies consume nectar from flowers and so gather energy from flowers that way and move it into their own bodies. And they also eat pollen, some of them, amazingly enough. Even though they have this long straw-like proboscis that they use to suck up nectar from the plants, they sometimes pick up pieces of pollen and they use their saliva to dissolve the pollen and extract the protein from it and take it in. Not very many butterflies do that, as far as we know at the moment. That's another way in which butterflies help move nutrients through the ecosystem.
Do they end up being pollinators as well?
Yes, very much so. Butterflies are among many animals that help pollinate plants by moving the pollen around from one flower to another.
Right. And pollination, of course, is really important for the plants to actually flower and to produce fruits.
There is one other thing that I would say that's kind of interesting about their role in the ecosystem is that in many species, the larvae feed on plants that contain compounds that are very distasteful, very sour, very bitter, cause indigestion, stomach problems in the predators. And those compounds, those chemicals that they get that they are in the plants that they're feeding on larvae, very often the larvae will take those on and they become part of the larvae's tissue. And then when the larva goes into the chrysalis or pupa stage, they're still there. And when the adult emerges from the pupa, those chemicals are still there and make the adult distasteful. So some butterflies actually have color patterns that announce this distastefulness. And they serve as models for other species of butterflies who, by virtue of mimicking their coloration, also gain some protection from predators.
Right.
Yeah.
In this case, there are those that really do taste really bad.
Yeah.
And those that pretend to be like the ones that taste really bad.
Right.
And both get the benefit.
That's right. Yeah.
Of all the butterflies, I'd have to say monarch butterflies are probably the most well-known and studied. I think one of the most intriguing parts of the monarch story is their migration. Can you talk just a little bit about monarch butterflies and their impressive yearly migration?
Of course, you can find lots of information on the migration of monarchs on the Ask a Biologist website, as well as other places on the web. you know, the key characteristics are that you have in the fall these butterflies that grew up, say, in southern Canada or the northeastern United States. They emerge from their pupa or chrysalis in the fall, and then they head south in the fall to these huge aggregations that form in the mountains near Mexico City. And that's in the east. In the west, we know that there are these winter aggregations that occur in the fall and stay in place through the winter all along the California coast between San Francisco and Mexico, basically. And those, we're not really as sure about where the butterflies in those aggregations come from. But we reckon they're from the mountains that are nearby, Sierra Nevada in California or other places in the Rocky Mountains. And then, of course, at both these locations in the spring, both along the California coast and in the mountains in Mexico, when the spring comes, the butterflies head back north or head back to where they came from, we think. So the two questions for me that are, I think are really interesting about that, one is, since I live and work in Arizona, one of the questions is, we're sort of halfway between the east and the west. Where do the butterflies here go? We do see a lot of monarchs flying through this area during the fall in particular. And there's a group of people in particular at a place called the Boyce Thompson Arboretum that are trying to sort this out by marking lots of butterflies out there, which is one of the key techniques to figure out where they go. So they see all these butterflies out there in the fall, they'll mark them, and then see if they end up in aggregations back in California or in aggregations down in Mexico.
When they mark them, do they use, is it a paint?
Or? No, it's a little sticky paper tag that they put on the wing.
Right.
They sort of wrap it around the front edge of the wing.
Wow.
And it stays on pretty well, and it works quite well. And it has phone numbers and stuff on there, so. You can
really tiny.
Actually, yeah, right. Yeah. And if you find one of these, you know, it tells you where to call and provide the information. So that to me is really interesting. Where do these butterflies, not just in Arizona, but in what's called the intermountain west, you know, in the Rocky Mountains, where do the butterflies go? So they may go to Mexico, they may go to California. We're not really all that sure. And of course, the other question for me, since most of my work is in the behavior and ecology of animals, is how they know where to go. In other words, during the fall, okay, we know that they head south. Well, how do they know which way is south? I mean, we have no way of knowing that unless we have a compass or if we know what time of day it is. So if you step outside and it's in the morning and you see the sun in a specific direction, the sun comes up in the east. That is probably east. So you'd know which way to go then. You know that if you face the sun at that time of day and head right, you will be headed south.
Correct.
And what's interesting is that there is now evidence that that's what monarchs do. They have an internal clock. They don't carry a wristwatch or have a clock on the wall to look at, but they have an internal clock that tells them what time of day it is. So when they look at the sun, they can interpret its location and figure out which way they have to go to head south. There are other experiments that are less clear in their results that have suggested that they might use wind currents. And so there's some feeling that maybe the prevailing winds across the eastern United States anyway during the fall are sort of southward, and that sort of propels the butterflies south, but that doesn't seem to be wholly satisfactory. Another proposal that's been made is that the butterflies actually have, as is known for other animals, to have an internalized ability to detect the orientation of the Earth's magnetic field in exactly the same way that a compass does, pretty much. I mean, that's what a compass responds to, is the Earth's magnetic field. Those experiments are less clear. I won't go into details about what's happened with those experiments, but right now the best evidence is that the monarchs, to figure out which way they have to go south, are using sort of a combination of the sun's position as evaluated using an internal clock that they have.
So they have this built-in sundial.
Yeah, that's one way to look at it, yeah.
Very neat. It's also interesting with the monarchs, just we need to mention a little bit again about ecology and the concern about what we're doing to the planet. Their wintering homes are, certainly in Mexico, have been shrinking.
Mm-hmm.
And we've also had discussions about the use of pesticides in their migration paths. How are we doing? For example, we had a really hard freeze, what was it, 2 or 3 years ago, and we lost a lot of them, and they were really concerned. But it seemed like they were more resilient than we thought.
Mm-hmm. You may mention two issues. One is the issue of these genetically modified corn and in the flight path of their migration. This corn has certain anti-insect agents actually built into its genome. When it produces pollen, these genes that produce these sort of anti-insect agents are in the pollen. It was proposed that this pollen might be bad for the insects to eat, in particular since the milkweeds on which the larval monarchs feed are right near these fields where this corn is grown or often grows up right in them. The worry was that these genetically engineered corns were having a very bad effect on the insect populations, and in particular the monarch populations. That's up in the air at the moment. I think there's still some people who think it's a very real issue, others who think it's not so significant, but it's something we should be concerned about. I like Lincoln Brower. He refers to the monarchs not as a endangered species or potentially endangered or threatened species, but as a threatened phenomena. The monarch is the one engaged in this fantastic phenomena, of which is this yearly migration. And so he says we need to be very concerned about it, and the concerns have to be international because the monarchs are flying from Canada into the U.S. and into Mexico. And the other issue is the one that Lincoln Brower is particularly concerned about is the decimation of the forests in which the overwintering habitats are found. So the monarchs have very specific habitat requirements during the winter in order to be able to survive the 3 months or more that they spend at these overwintering sites. They can't be too hot or they dehydrate. They can't be too cold or they freeze to death. They can't be too wet. They can't be too dry. Again, it's tricky for an animal of that size to survive the 3 months of winter in these under these exposed conditions. The mountains where they occur are subjected to very intensive logging. And when you say that the overwintering areas have been decreasing in size, what's been decreasing in size are the patches of forest where the habitats that are suitable for spending the winter are found. So various groups, both in Mexico and the U.S., are working very hard to make sure that those habitats are protected. If you look, there are certain websites you can go to, and you can actually see plots of the size of the overwintering aggregations and how it's changed over the years. And you're right, a couple of years ago, it was way down. But over the last couple of years, it's come back up. I don't know if it's quite at about the average. It's not the highest it's ever been. There was some time in the early 90s or 1980s when it was just immense, during the period of time that they've been sampling this. But they're of reasonable size if you look at the history of them over the last 15 or 20 or so years.
Well, if people need to learn more about monarch butterflies, they can do this by visiting the Ask a Biologist website. Just click on the articles link and locate the migrating monarch story, or click on the experiments and stuff to get to our coloring page section where you can find a coloring page on the life cycle of the monarch butterfly. You've been listening to an interview with Professor Ron Rutowski. This is part one of a 3-part series. Please join me for part 2 of the series. We'll be talking about Professor Rutowski's research on butterfly coloration and insect vision. I'm Dr. Biology.